Today is Thursday, September 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up, Prime Minister Herbert Minnis from the Bahamas says the hurricane recovery effort will be long.
Day after day, week after week, month after month.
Also ahead, the Brexit debate turns personal for the British Prime Minister, and the Syrian city of Raqqa struggles to rebuild. It's all on today's International Edition. The battle over Brexit continues in London. Yesterday, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson lost key votes in Parliament and has not been able to get an agreement for his plan to call snap elections before Britain is scheduled to leave the EU next month. Today, Brexit turned into a family drama for the Prime Minister. Our reporter Henry Ridgewell, who is covering the Brexit debate for VOA from our London office, is on the line with us now to give us an update on this. Thanks for joining us, Henry.
Great to be with you, Kim.
Well, Henry, what is happening today between the Prime Minister and Parliament, first of all?
Well, today, Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, was not actually in Parliament. He made a trip up to the north of England today to make a speech about boosting police numbers. And the images on television screens looked all the world like the launch of an election campaign, which effectively many people see as what is happening right now. As you were saying just there, yesterday in Parliament, Boris Johnson suffered two humiliating defeats. First of all, the House of Commons passed a law blocking him from leaving the EU with no deal on October the 31st. Secondly, when he tried to then call a snap election, he didn't get enough votes to do so. So we're seeing a wounded Prime Minister just weeks into his premiership. The political honeymoon is well and truly over. He is desperate to call an election because he has now completely lost his majority in Parliament. In fact, he's in negative territory now. But we're in a situation where the opposition parties are enjoying watching him sweat, watching him stew in this political mess, and will probably string it out for a few days more until we see the emergence of what may happen for Britain. We know that the government plans to bring another vote to Parliament on Monday next week for a snap election that would likely be held on October the 15th. But the opposition parties want the election after the Brexit deadline on October the 31st to make sure that this piece of legislation blocking no deal goes through, that it's on the statute books so that Britain won't crash out. And then they say, bring it on, we want an election.
Also, what are the chances of the Conservative Party split?
Well, I think they're very high at the moment. Just today, we saw Boris Johnson's younger brother, Joe Johnson, who was the Universities and Science Minister, resign, not only from his government post, but as an MP, saying that he could no longer reconcile family loyalties with the national interest. And so, of course, that brings the question that the opposition will bring. Well, if his own brother can't trust him, then how can we? And this comes off the back of the Conservative Party purging 21 of its MPs this week, many of them very, very senior members. The father of the House, Ken Clark, the grandson of wartime Prime Minister Winston Churchill, that's Nicholas Soames, all of them effectively thrown out of the party for voting against the government. So I think we are already seeing a split of sorts in the Conservative Party. Whether it formally splits and there are two blocks that form, one on the right wing of the party, perhaps led by Boris Johnson, and another moderate, we'll have to wait and see. But certainly it's a party in great turmoil at the moment.
Also, I understand that the Prime Minister met today with U.S. Vice President Mike Pence. How did this meeting turn out? I do understand that the U.S. does support Britain's decision to leave the EU.
It does, and that is something that Boris Johnson is drawing on heavily. Of course, after Britain leaves the European Union, we have to still say if it leaves the European Union, it's looking for international allies to back up its claim that it's going to be a global Britain. And Mike Pence underlined the attitude of the White House and Washington by offering his support to Britain's policy of Brexit. And just yesterday, we had Donald Trump saying that Boris Johnson is a fighter and he knows how to win. I think those will be comforting words from Britain's strongest transatlantic ally at this time. But there is a limited amount of help that the Americans can give Britain at the moment. It finds itself in very difficult political territory. The other point is, of course, that even if Britain does crash out with no deal, we are so entwined with the European economy that the first trade deal, the first relationship that we'll need sorting out is with Europe. A trade deal with America would be great, but given most of our trade and many of our vital imports come from Europe on November the 1st, that's the first relationship that we'll need sorting. So an important boost, international boost with this visit, but in fact it doesn't change much in terms of the calculations for Boris Johnson.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for that update. That's our Henry Ridgewell reporting for VOA in London. Well, aid agencies are racing to get help.
Okay, thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Victims of Hurricane Dorian in the Bahamas, which was devastated by the storm. Tim McGuire with the Associated Press reports.
Bahamian Prime Minister Hubert Minnis says the recovery on Abaco and Grand Bahama Islands will be a hard slog.
Day after day, week after week, month after month, until the lives of our people return to some degree of normalcy.
Minnis says the damage from Hurricane Dorian is far more extensive on Abaco than Grand Bahama. The prime minister adding several international agencies and organizations have pledged aid, including $1 million each from the United Nations and Disney Cruise Line. I'm Tim McGuire.
Well, the hurricane is now heading north along the southeastern coast of the United States. The states of North Carolina and South Carolina are being hit today. Richard Pasch, a senior hurricane specialist at the National Hurricane Center, gave reporters the forecast.
It's moving northward at about 7 miles per hour, should turn toward the north-northeast, and over the next few days turn northeastward, and with an increase in forward speed. But you know, that track would appear to keep it offshore, but it's going to pass actually very close to the coastline of South and North Carolina.
Well, the American Red Cross is among the organizations helping storm victims in the Bahamas and in the U.S. Anthony Tornetta is a spokesperson with the American Red Cross working on the Hurricane Dorian relief effort. He spoke with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson about the work being done.
But Bahamas Red Cross actually had a chance to pre-position hundreds of Red Cross responders. And they pre-positioned emergency response assets and equipment to be prepared as the storm made landfall. Now, the storm came across the Bahamas and settled, and it was very intense. And just like everybody else, we're starting to see the visuals. We're starting to see the devastation that was caused. And our hearts go out to those that have been impacted. We know that about 13,000 homes are believed to have been damaged or destroyed in the Bahamas. This is definitely becoming an international response. And so that's where we stand right now.
As you mentioned, in the Bahamas, they had prepped for this storm. How has the American Red Cross been prepping for the storm's impact, both in Florida and then now in the Carolinas?
We actually activated and deployed almost 2,000 trained responders across Florida, Georgia, and the Carolinas. We also had the ability to activate over 110 emergency response vehicles and 100 tractor trailers full of emergency supplies. So think cots, blankets, cases of water, cleanup kits, things, hygiene kits, things that people are going to need immediately following a disaster. I can tell you that last night alone, we saw approximately 9,000 people spend the night in evacuation shelters across the four states that we're talking about. So it's been an active response. It's an ongoing response, but it's something that we train for and we're prepared for, and we're ready to help.
The initial reaction of most people when they see these disasters is to want to help. What is the best way for people to help, both in the Bahamas or, you know, any big disaster? What's the best way to help?
Yeah, so when we see storms with the size and scope of this type of hurricane, people, the goodness in people generally comes out, and they really want to help. They really want to give back. If you have the ability to make a financial contribution, we encourage you to visit redcross.org. You can make a financial contribution there. You can text the word Dorian to 90999, and that will help those impacted in Florida, Georgia, and the Carolinas. If you're living in an international location and you're looking to support the Bahamas relief effort, we encourage you to go to your local Red Cross, and you can make a contribution there. That money will go and help the people impacted in the Bahamas.
That was Anthony Tornetta, a spokesperson with the American Red Cross, speaking with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson. Among the top stories in the world, China says it will resume high-level trade talks with the United States in October. South Africa closes its embassies in Nigeria after protest because of anti-immigrant violence in South Africa. India restores telephone lines in Kashmir a month after cutting most telecommunications to the region. And the 25-year-old son of the late Egyptian president Mohamed Morsi has died of a heart attack. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. A Taliban spokesman said the group is responsible for a suicide car bombing today in Afghanistan's capital that killed at least 10 people. Sagar Magani with the Associated Press has more.
It was a suicide car bombing in a busy diplomatic area of Kabul, the second such attack this week amid word of a preliminary deal with the Taliban on ending America's longest war. The Afghan government's warned the negotiations are moving dangerously fast, that talking peace with a group that's still killing innocents is meaningless. The American was the fourth U.S. service member killed the past 2 weeks. A Romanian soldier also died, and dozens of people were wounded. Sagar Magani at the White House.
The U.S. deal with the Taliban reportedly includes the withdrawal of 5,000 U.S. troops. In turn, the Taliban must prevent terrorist attacks from being launched in Afghanistan against the U.S. or its allies. The Taliban also will be required to open talks with Afghan officials. However, last night, the American magazine Time reported that U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo will not sign the deal, in part because the Taliban demands it include language that effectively recognizes the group as a legitimate political entity.
The U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Brian Hook, says the United States is committed to its campaign to push Iran to renegotiate the 2015 agreement on restricting its nuclear activities. President Donald Trump withdrew the United States from the deal last year. The administration wants a stronger deal and is pushing Tehran to end what Washington says are a range of activities that destabilize the Middle East.
The United States government is intensifying our maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic of Iran. First, we are announcing a reward of up to $15 million for any person who helps us disrupt the financial operations of Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps and Quds Force.
Hook said Iran used a network led by the Revolutionary Guard and its Quds Force to hide and sell more than $500 million worth of oil earlier this year.
The Department of the Treasury today designated more than 25 entities and individuals and 11 vessels involved in this shipping network. Those who engage in transactions with these entities, individuals, and vessels are now exposed to U.S. sanctions.
U.S. officials say proceeds from oil sales fund Iran's nuclear and missile programs and support terrorist groups such as Lebanon's Hezbollah and the Revolutionary Guard. Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif on Thursday described the new U.S. sanctions as economic terrorism. The latest U.S. sanctions were announced after French President Emmanuel Macron offered Iran a $15 million line of credit to entice it to comply with the nuclear agreement. The offer came as a part of a European effort to offset the pain caused by U.S. sanctions and to salvage the nuclear agreement with Iran. Iran turned down the French offer and said it would begin new nuclear activities starting Friday, which would violate the nuclear deal. Mohammed El-Shenawi, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA's International Edition.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules. It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
Two years ago, Kurdish forces captured control of the Syrian city of Raqqa from the Islamic State militants. The months of fighting destroyed much of the city. VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch has just been in Raqqa and found a city struggling to recover, both physically and emotionally. She spoke with my colleague, Kate Pound Dawson, about life in Raqqa.
At this point, a lot of the public places in Raqqa have been rebuilt or are being rebuilt at the moment. There is international support for the rebuilding of roads and public buildings. Unfortunately, private homes don't have any support in terms of rebuilding and private businesses. So there's still a lot of homes, a lot of businesses, and a lot of areas that are still completely crushed from the battle with Islamic State militants that ended in 2017. In terms of recovering emotionally, they're still digging bodies out of mass graves. In the past 2 years, they found 5,000 bodies, and only 700 of them have been identified as of yet. They don't have the capacity, the money, or the scientific capacity to do forensic or DNA testing. So they're relying entirely on people seeing their loved ones' clothes or hair. And as time goes on, it becomes more and more impossible. So they are hoping to get more help to identify the bodies, but at this point they're still digging up more.
What other challenges or concerns are there going forward in rebuilding the city?
Well, in a lot of areas, water has been restored and some rebuilding is being done, but there's also a lot of areas that don't have electricity. Several people told us in Raqqa, you know, if we could just have electricity in our neighborhood, we would just fix everything else ourselves. But the electrical problems are a huge economic economic problem for everyone. And there's also security problems. People still don't feel safe in Raqqa.
Why not?
Well, there's a general feeling, and I think it is backed up by plenty of evidence, that there's still quite a bit of support for Islamic State militants and that ideology. And the people running Raqqa right now are the Kurdish authorities from the self-administration. And these are the same people that beat the Islamic State militants. So those that supported the militancy are now living under the enemy, essentially. And the ideology, at least the strict interpretation of Islam, isn't so far off from what is more commonly acceptable in Raqqa. It's a pretty conservative town. So average people are afraid that those who take the ideology to the extreme and believe in violence will return to power. They're very afraid. In fact, people won't say bad things about Islamic State in public, mostly in Raqqa, because they're afraid that it's coming back.
Well, how can the community, or is the community trying to sort of reintegrate Islamic State supporters into civilian society?
There's a sort of desperation in Raqqa about that exact issue. There are some efforts being made, as in like there's a school for young people, students that have been trained to be part of the Ashbella Khalafa, which is the youth wing of Islamic State militancy in northeastern Syria, and the school intended to retrain. But the problem is that there's so much extremism that it's like some of the most hardcore militants were very recently arrested and their families were put into camps. And the people that come from this extreme among extremists point of view don't seem to be movable. The general idea is that for the average Islamic State militants that sort of melted into society as opposed to getting arrested or in jail, or the average supporter that's not in jail, if the economy is strong and they are free to live their lives, they probably won't have any desire to return to a militancy. But there's so many supporters and extremists in the area, people are kind of desperate to find a way to bridge the gap and bring society together. But so far, not much has happened.
That was VOA's Heather Murdoch speaking with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson. While the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights is concerned about the U.S. administration's asylum policy, which she says may be in breach of international human rights law, Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the High Commissioner's headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Rights Chief does not question the sovereign right of the United States or any other country to adopt migration and asylum policies that are in line with their national interests. But she says the laws must be in keeping with international human rights law. Michelle Bachelet says policies that restrict migration must be in compliance with standards that do not put people's lives at risk. She notes migrants unable to enter a country through a legal crossing point will find other routes, which could put them in danger. She says she has some reservations about the new Trump policy of keeping asylum seekers waiting on the Mexican side of the border until their cases come to court. Before anyone is returned to Mexico, she says the United States must study the case to determine whether the person is a refugee and entitled to international protection.
We believe that the policies, measures that have been adopted by many countries, and in the case of the United States, some countries like Central American countries, are putting people in more vulnerable situations.
Bachelet tells VOA she is opposed to the U.S. policy of family separation. She says she has received reports that family separations also are occurring in Mexico. In July, she notes, the U.S. House Oversight and Reform Committee said that hundreds of children have been separated from their families since the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy was enacted in June 2018.
We do believe that the arbitrary separation of families constitute an arbitrary and unlawful interference with family life and a grave violation of the rights of the child. It's against all the legal conventions and international human rights law and the laws for the child.
Bachelet says detaining children for longer than 21 days is both unconscionable and unlawful. She says she has heard it could take up to 2 years before asylum cases are adjudicated. She calls this a matter of great concern and hopes the process can be speeded up. If not, she urges U.S. authorities to ensure that asylum seekers are protected while they are waiting. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. Social media company Facebook is entering a new frontier in the United States, love. The Associated Press's Charles de Ledesma has more.
Facebook Dating, a matchmaking service the company already offers in Brazil, Canada, and 17 other countries, now gets to the US. But after years of privacy missteps, will people trust it with their love lives? Tinder and other apps already use Facebook's data to suggest matches, while Facebook Dating, while being free to use and free of ads, will accrue revenue if it keeps people glued to its other services. But some users worry Facebook's stated commitments to privacy would ultimately buckle under pressure to make money off the service. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Taking a quick look back in time, in 1774, the First Continental Congress assembled in Philadelphia. In 1960, at the Rome Olympics, American boxer Cassius Clay, later known worldwide as Muhammad Ali, won the light heavyweight gold medal. You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Nadia Taha, our engineer, Sidrak Franklin. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.